Hey, welcome back. This is the second hour of today's edition of Truth Be Had Radio, right here on We the People Radio Network. Last half hour, I've been speaking with Steve Alton, author of The Shell Game. I believe we still have Steve on the line, and we're also bringing on the next guest, Dr. Faiz Khan. Dr. Faiz Khan was the original American Muslim 9/11 truth activist. A pretty tough role, I can imagine, because it's tough enough for me post-2004, but Faiz was doing it from almost the get-go. He was a first responder to the victims of 9/11. He was working in American Jewish Hospital of New York, I believe, at the time, and quickly started mobilizing for truth, and was instrumental in my decision to help put together the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. He's a co-founder of that group. It's on the web still at MUJCA.com. As I said earlier, the Christians have taken over now. It may have been co-founded by a couple of Muslims, but it's now in capable Christian hands, and we're hoping we can eventually maybe see it handed over to Jews. So we're going to try, and at least that's the theory. I don't know. Lou Stoltenberg is the head of that group right now, and so she'll pretty much be making those decisions. But anyway, Faiz was a great inspiration to me in deciding to embark on this career in 9/11 truth activism and writing. Now, I guess, politics. I don't have your bio in front of me right now, Faiz, but Faiz is a very active individual. He's a medical doctor and has been involved in a number of video projects. He has lectured widely on Islam and has some of the same interests as I do in terms of his approach to Islam. And he is hoping to organize a conference in the not-too-distant future, focusing on the topic of counterfeiting religion, arguing that the Islam that was set up in the 9/11 attacks is a counterfeit form of Islam, and that there are counterfeit forms of religion out there that we need to be on guard against. And his essay in 9/11 and American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out, carries forth that argument, as well as addressing the question of where are the Muslims in terms of working for 9/11 truth. Where's the American Muslim community? It's a very important essay, and it's an honor to welcome Dr. Faiz Khan.
Well, welcome. Thank you, Kevin. Walaikum assalam, Kevin. It's always great to touch base with you, and it's an honor to be on your show.
No, it's always great to have you. And Steve, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Hey, great. We've also got Steve Alton, author of The Shell Game, on the line. We could hang out for a little bit of a Muslim-Jewish dialogue here. We probably have some Christian callers who could join in, too. We can have a little Mujka session, if you want, Faiz.
Sure.
Yeah. So Faiz, what got you on the road to the 9/11 truth movement? You were on board very, very early, so maybe you could tell your story for our listeners.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, as you had mentioned, you know, I'm actually an emergency physician, so who was working in New York City, and the day the trade towers went down, and you know, just helped out and was part of the rescue and resuscitation efforts, and initially, you know, bought the whole, you know, this is, you know, Muslims gone bad, plus, you know, an overwhelmed or incompetent intelligence apparatus, hence, you know, this happened. But after just sort of doing my own research with some of the initial sort of pioneers of 9/11 truth, Mike Rupert in particular, then there was Nafiz Ahmed, who wrote 9/11 about 9/11, not just 9/11, but the origin of these militant Islamic networks, so-called militant Islamic networks, that opened my eyes. And I realized that if you just look at the empirical data, the mainstream thesis is completely absurd. But as I think you would probably put it best, it was more of a psychological operation than it was anything else, because just the images of those trade centers going down over and over and over again with the media parroting the line, you know, bin Laden, militant Islam, it's, you know, the damage was done, irrespective of how much you know, evidence comes out to the contrary.
Right. And you've worked on the question of the counterfeit Islam of these so-called militant Islamic networks. I know in your essay in 9/11 and American Empire, Volume 2, you argue that there are indeed these militant Islamic networks, or there are militant Muslims out there. Many of them are bad news, but that's not the explanation for 9/11.
No. I mean, just from what I know of going to that region of the world, the Middle East, and also in India and Pakistan, I mean, sure, you're going to have, militant type activist Muslims that you know, you'll have your once in a while, you know, Shia versus Sunni rumbles, you know, after Friday prayer somewhere in an alleyway in Pakistan or India. But to assume that these folks get access to shape chargers and advanced weapons technology and blow up each other's mosques, that's absurd. Even the high-level clerics now, in Shia and Sunni clerics, both in Iraq and Iran, have acknowledged that this is not the work of our the mutual antagonism between us. This is some other third party that is trying to mimic the counterfeit Islamic, trying to mimic the Islamists. The same thing happened in Algeria as well with the quote-unquote militant wing of the Islamic resurgence. That was shown to be a complete fraud, and government and French Secret Service sponsored. So, I mean, it shouldn't come as any surprise that when we read this level of activity that alters geopolitics, that uses advanced intelligence, that uses advanced weapon technology, these are not these, you know, rabble rousers. This is something of covert operations and counterfeit false flag operations.
Right. And Steve, in the shell game, you portrayed some of these patsies, these apparent Islamist patsies, and some people criticized you for portraying them because, you know, that these were people who didn't finish the book, apparently, and maybe, you know, didn't quite realize that they were patsies. What kind of research did you do to get into the heads of those kind of people?
I had some fans who are Muslims who live over in those countries and have given me some of the insights that they had to go through during the first Iraq war. You have to present a human approach, because these are human beings too, and many of them are victims of U.S. aggression, and you know, there are radicals of all kinds, and the neocons are certainly radicals, and there are radicals in Israel and radicals in Russia, but that doesn't mean that that most of the people are like that, although they are susceptible to those type of, like we talked about before, psychopathic influences.
Right, and it seems to me that of the patsies, let's take the 9/11 patsies as an example. Some of them don't seem to me to be radical Muslims in any sense of the word. They rather seem to be intelligence agents playing a role. I'm thinking of people like the Muhammad Atta, who was out drinking and partying and snorting coke and going off the casino boats into Las Vegas. But others do seem like they might be sincere but very stupid radical Muslims. People like Zacharias Massawi, who was cheering in his prison cell, I believe, when 9/11 happened, or Richard Reed, the so-called shoe bomber, who couldn't get a match lit to light the fuse on his shoe. But it does seem that with these patsies, either they're totally counterfeit intelligence agents, and many of them clearly are, or the ones who aren't, again, like the street people that they tried to nail for trying to blow up the Sears Tower, those are just street people. And FBI hands them, here's $50,000 to blow up the Sears Tower. You want to take it? Oh, well, I'll take your $50,000. You know, so these are people who are just, you know, not very bright, not very capable, and easily manipulated. What do you think, Fuzz? Are there any competent radical Muslims who would actually think that it would make sense to carry off big attacks on U.S. soil?
No, I don't believe so. It would make no sense. Again, that's just my own opinion. Just based on, I mean, every event that has shaken the world. I mean, just if you just start scratching the surface and chasing leads, things get very suspicious very quickly as to who exactly the perpetrators were, whether a story was floated and fabricated. That's my own experience.
Right. It kind of makes sense from the strategic standpoint. I can't imagine how anybody like bin Laden, who wants the U.S. out of the Middle East, why does he think that a big attack in the U.S. would accomplish those goals. Obviously, a big spectacular attack would just get the U.S. much further ensconced into the Middle East. And at the same time, there may be excitable individuals that could be recruited to serve the roles as patsies.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, the whole homicide or suicide attacks that occur, you know, on Israeli soil and on different in different areas of the world. I mean, I am convinced that that is probably an actuality. However, every time a suicide bomber, conveniently shows up to do something, I'm not sure that that's always the case. So the phenomenon is certainly real. You know, these militant types, I think, as Steve is saying, they are out there. The extent on which every event is actually a result of these folks, that's a different issue. I mean, that's, you're asking us to trust mainstream corporate media, and I just, at this point, have learned not to trust what I read.
I think it's pretty amazing, Kevin, that for such an intelligence failure on this scale that the Bush administration, of course, they didn't say it was a failure, just mishaps, but within 12 hours from not knowing anything, they knew every hijacker's name, bio, and had a picture of them so that it was running on every mainstream newspaper on the front page. You know, that was a lot of catch-up to do for intelligence work in 12 hours.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and I think that underlines the whole psyop element of this event. The psychological penetrance of the American public was completely moldable at that point. So, Steve, that just underlines the psyop nature of it.
Yeah, and they want to get stuff out early. That's one of the things that you learn when you study these operations is. People are malleable right after it happens. That's the moment when they have to hammer people with the propaganda. And that's why they jump the gun sometimes. Maybe that's why Building 7 was reported to have collapsed 20 minutes before it happened by the BBC. Somebody was trying to put that out right away, get that out fast. You know, just like they jumped the gun nailing Oswald for the JFK assassination. Apparently somebody screwed up and didn't remember that there was an international dateline. So they put Oswald's complete biography into the Stars and Stripes in New Zealand before the
correct.
Committee would even been erected.
Correct. Well, that's a well-known thing. I mean, my own research as a medical physician, you know, I work in the ER, and we've shown recurrently that just, you know, as far as altering the behavior of patients in terms of getting them to do healthier things and living longer, that if you say something in the context of a visit in the emergency room, as opposed to saying the identical thing in the context of a visit with a primary care doctor where it's an elective visit, the penetrance is far more greater in terms of altering behavior when the patient is in the emergency room, just because it's a stressful environment, a lot of things are happening, they're usually there because there might be a given problem. So if I were to tell you to stop smoking if you were in the ER, as opposed to tell you to stop smoking at a routine doctor's visit, you're probably more likely to stop smoking after your ER visit. So that's a well-known tactic in terms of changing behavior and altering consciousness.
You're telling us that you're practicing coercion.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I'm beginning to do the research in the context of preventing falls in the elderly, and that's a huge problem in this country. And I'm starting to demonstrate that if you essentially scare them. Hello?
Yeah, we're getting some strange background noises.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Yeah.
It's okay. Just talk on, hopefully, these strange background noises.
Hello?
Hello, you still there, Paz?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I can hear that as well, yeah.
I think that was the NSA. They brought in the a really incompetent crew. I think it was the same people who wired up Building 7 and tried to get that gun down. It didn't go off. They brought them in to tap our phone lines.
I mean, again, without getting into details, the point is that when there are certain times where you can influence people's consciousness and behavior and decision making and understanding of things and you know the more stress there is in an environment, the easier it is to do that. And that's essentially what happened.
Well, that's exactly what Doug Rushkoff talked about in his terrific book Coercion, about how, and also of course Naomi Klein in her book The Shock Doctrine. In both cases, they discussed how a certain kind of really strong mind control directed at the unconscious is facilitated by people, you know, being in these extremely stressful situations.
Yeah.
Their whole normal reality has somehow been broken down.
Yeah.
I think the most distressful thing to me about the whole 9/11 situation, obviously the crimes and the murders, you know, would be the top, but the coercion of the mainstream media and whether that was for dollar value or for whatever influence that they simply caved in and have continued to form a gauntlet against anything coming out about 9/11 truth, to me is very dismaying. And Kevin, you and I had an email exchange earlier this week about the you know, the architects and engineers who came out with their press release, and just about nobody picked it up. And I thought that was very distressing.
Yeah, well, it is. And likewise, they're refusing to bring you on to talk about the Dell game. You sent out 1,000-plus press releases and didn't get a whole lot of response. Well, we just have to keep hammering at them, and we'll be back to keep on hammering at the radio in just a moment. So stick around. This is Kevin Barrett. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett. I do the show every weekend, 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, right here on We the People Radio Network. Today I'm talking with Dr. Faz Khan, who is the original American 9/11, Muslim 9/11 truth activist, and Steve Alton, the author of The Shell Game. Steve is a Jewish American, and I was thinking that maybe I could ask each of you guys, this is probably a little easier for Faz because he's written an article about this. What is it that has prevented the American Muslim and Jewish communities from coming on board looking for 9/11 truth? Neither community has really been particularly exemplary in this regard. You would think that Muslims, just for their own self-interest, would be out there holding up signs saying, hey, we didn't do it. But for some reason, they're not. And Faz has written an article about that. And likewise, the American Jewish community has not really distinguished itself in terms of saying never again, let's stand up for the victimized people, you know, the Muslims victimized by this psyop. We've had a few notable exceptions, like Rabbi Michael Lerner, who contributed a terrific essay to the book that Faz's essay is in, which I edited, 9/11 American Empire Volume 2. But we also have the Simon Wiesenthal Center leading the charge against 9/11 truth, and the Jewish community has really not been any better than the Muslim community on this. So let's start with Faz. Faz, why is it that the American Muslim community has failed so abysmally to stand up for the truth about 9/11?
Just, again, this is forcing me to rehash also the points in my book, which I'm going to do my best to do quickly.
Haven't read that yet.
I'm sorry?
Probably the listeners, many of the listeners won't have read that, so you can go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I thought it was an excellent collection of essays, and again, not to promote my own essay, but it was excellent. The first thing, obviously, is the American Muslim community here is still primarily the immigrant population, so they are just essentially scared to rabble-rouse at this point because, understandably, you can get very quickly targeted, discredited, and they hear stories about people just sort of going into detention centers and such. So fear is one of them. Number two, just incompetence, intellectual incompetence. And most of them are like other people, and they watch their news maybe for half an hour portion of the day, and they're out working and sleeping and spending time with their family. So they haven't been inclined to critically think about this. So I would say those are two main things. But my whole argument was if you're not going to make noise about it like a Kevin Barrett is doing, then at least don't promote the mainstream explanation, because you are by default being an agent of disinformation. And that's something I learned very quickly, because I was initially caught up in the, oh, those are bad Muslims, this is what real Islam is. But I, after just looking at the evidence, I said, well, those weren't even bad Muslims. This was a complete false flag operation. So to even promote that thesis is to spread disinformation. And I think that's obvious. When the premise of your argument is a lie and you use that argument, it's going to be deceitful. So that was more of my complaint against the American Muslim community.
Well, I think you're right. There are so many American Muslims who've been jumping up and down and saying, hey, I'm not one of those bad Muslims. Like,
it's an industry. The moderate Islam beat, which I was almost dragged into becoming part of, is a huge, there's so much funding for it right now. It's a great, let's heal the division between Islam and the West. This whole thing is, if this was about religion, not about politics and resources and various ideologies, that whole thing is a false thesis. And I'm happy not to be part of it at this point.
Right. Yeah, I used to be sort of more of a pro-moderation kind of Muslim prior to 9/11, and actually post 9/11, I've gotten a little bit less moderate. So, Steve, what do you think about the American Jewish community's response to 9/11? Any thoughts?
Well, I think after 9/11 initially happened, there were plenty of members of the Jewish community who came out as a community and basically stated, let's not start rounding up Muslims. In response to 9/11. In regards to 9/11 truth, however, I don't think you could sort of quantify 9/11 truth as or categorize it as from a religious standpoint. I mean, there's people come up, people come to 9/11 truth on their own journeys, not usually as a group. You're not going to have go into a synagogue or a church and have somebody stand up and start presenting evidence about 9/11 truth. People come to those things. They come to blogs. They read a book. They listen to somebody on a radio, and they come up with those conclusions themselves, but not as a group. And so I don't think it's to expect a group to come up with it. It's easier to find a political group that would come up with 9/11 truth than it would be a religious group.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. And, of course, that's one of the things that's made the Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth such a big and kind of frustrating task, trying to get it into these houses of worship, trying to get religious communities to take a look at this issue, which does have so much moral significance. And the religions are supposedly the guardians of morality. They claim to have the metaphysical last word or insight on which morality is grounded. And so my take is that they do, people who are, thinking of themselves as having that particular, grounding in morality should be willing to look at this very, very clear and vivid kind of moral issue, which really exposes the evil behind the empire that staged this event as part of its imperial project, which has killed millions and millions of people around the world. One would think that the morality sector of society, and religion is certainly part of that, would be more willing to take a hard look at this.
Well, I had an interesting experience when I was promoting the shell game. I was invited to speak at a literary festival on the process of writing, and the other panelist was Stephen King's son. And so the two of us were giving our advice about how to write, and I used the opportunity to bring up what the shell game was about and presented the information in as quickly a manner as I could about the Bush administration and the war games and the warnings and the put options and the FBI investigations and on down the line. And when I was done, King's son sort of attacked my theories by stating that, first of all, that would be impossible for those things to happen because the Bush administration isn't very intelligent. And that sort of got him a round of applause, and to which I responded in kind, and we sort of debated back and forth for a while. And it sort of demonstrated to me that the ignorance that's out there that it's easier to dismiss a notion that seems so preposterous without delving into it and realizing how logical it is.
Well, it sure is. Hey, by the way, Steve, is there a YouTube video of that encounter? It's certainly too bad if there isn't.
There's not, but I just did an interview 2 days ago for a show on CN8 called One on One with Steve Avedado, and that'll be shown on October 21st, and we'll make sure that's a YouTube.
Okay, great. You know, usually these kinds of encounters with celebrities tend to make very popular YouTube videos. For instance, when I was questioning Amy Goodman about Building 7, that did very well on YouTube. And I think Steve Alton versus Stephen King's son would have been a wonderful book for a YouTube video. Okay, we're coming into the break. We'll be back with more conversation after that. If you want to join the conversation, well, it's getting pretty crowded here. This is like the stateroom scene in the Marx Brothers, but you can try. You can call in here at area code 512-646-1984. That's 512-646-1984.
To the people. You're listening to We the People Radio Network.
Welcome back to Truth We Had Radio. Kevin Barrett talking today with Faz Khan. He's the original American Muslim 9/11 truth activist, as well as a medical doctor and 9/11 first responder. And Steve Alton just signed off. So I guess people can check out his great novel, The Shell Game, at theshellgame.net. I believe it is .net. Faz, I guess we do have half an hour left, I believe, and it is Ramadan, and we're both fasting for Ramadan. Many of my listeners won't really know what that's about. You want to enlighten them?
Oh, sure. As some of your listeners might know, but Ramadan is the ninth, sort of the ninth lunar month of the Islamic calendar. It's for roughly 30 days. A Muslim who will try their best not to eat or drink, engage in sex, cigarettes, all of that stuff is out between sunrise and sunset for 29 to 30 or 30 contiguous days, depending on, the sighting of the moon. I think, Kevin, you and I and most Muslims will agree that the physiologic part of the fast, that is to abstain from food and drink, is probably the easier part, because of course, along with the external part of the fast, there's not losing one's temper and trying to be generous and being patient being honest and lowering trying to keep a check on one's lusts. All these things are just is much a part of the fasting as it is to abstain from food and drink. So, that whole, it's sort of an increase in spiritual tone for, 29 to 30 days that most Muslims try to participate in. And that's essentially it.
Right. And as far as, what does that do? Why would people do this? I have people sort of, a little confused about that sometimes. And I think it probably brings a lot of benefits. I mean, people have said that, like Aldous Huxley said, fasting is the royal road to spiritual experience.
Sure.
I don't know. I wonder if there's another religion that really prescribes a certain kind, everybody fasting for that long at the same time. And there are some shorter fasts. Can you think of other examples of major religions having?
Oh, sure. Well, what's I think what the American public, it's nice for them to know is that from at least a from a Quranic perspective, the Quran actually informs the Prophet Muhammad that his is not the way of Muhammad. This is the way of Abraham, which means that all of these rituals that we do have their precedent in pre-Muhammadan times. So, you know, Christ fasted, 40 days. Moses fasted. Buddha fasted. So fasting is a ritual and an activity that has its precedent in faith traditions long, much before Muhammad it is. So the question is why? Well, there's a lot of reasons why. The main reason is because this is what is asked by God for us to do. But there's a lot of benefits that people notice. For instance, the psycho-spiritual heightening of one's consciousness and being more in touch with one's own psyche and soul. Then there's, physiologic benefits, social benefits. You sort of learn and empathize with others, perhaps, that can't do with food and drink as easily as we can. There's physiologic benefits. Many people are not aware, but when you abstain from a normal carbohydrate intake, your body begins to manufacture what's called ketone bodies. And ketones are actually the preferred fuel for the brain and the heart to use to meet its metabolic requirements, which I thought was an interesting tidbit, So, there's all these hidden benefits of fasting, but ultimately it's about being compliant with something that God has asked the believer to do. And, Christians will fast Lent, Hindus fast certain days, and, of course, Jews fast in the High Holy Days. So, fasting is something that's been recognized as an activity that keeps one in touch with the divine.
Once I started fasting, I realized that there was a very powerful change in consciousness and kind of a dissociation from normal sensory desires and material life.
Yes.
I wonder whether that isn't partly preparing us for life after death, that is, life without a body. Many of the great spiritual traditions tell us that our souls go on after our bodies die, and consciousness is still there without the body. The Buddhists have the Tibetan Book of the Dead talking about that transition out of the body and the things that you have to watch out for and what you should be sort of focusing on. The importance, in other words, of being prepared in life for your death, something that all the religions talk about. And I wonder if fasting isn't partly about that.
I'm sure. Again, no one individual has the final authority on what fasting is about. I think actually I've seen amongst modernists of all religions, they try to sort of put a material utility onto a ritual. And I remember, saying, why do Muslims pray? And then someone, my father used to say, we pray because it helps us feel peaceful. And I would say, I have other ways of making me feel peaceful. I don't need this ritual. It's the same thing with fasting. I mean, there's a lot of ways to empathize with the people who don't have food. There's a lot of ways to be physiologically more optimal. But fasting has its own value. And it is a ritual. I think people forget that rituals have meaning in and of themselves. They don't need to sort of manifest in various indices. But like you said, there's definitely a discernible observation, like you said. For you, you feel that it may heighten your awareness of the life after death. Certainly that's a valid thing. For me, I can tell you, and I think for many people, I can see the spiritual toxins in my heart a lot clearer when I'm fasting. I can see my anger beginning to come at me before it even manifests. You can see your lusts before they actually grab hold of you. So that's another thing. There's a saying of the Prophet that the demons are chained during Ramadan. And some of the masters have said that might have to do with the fact that you can look into your own psyche a lot clearer and see the various attacks of negative spiritual influences.
Well, that's an interesting insight, and it kind of makes me think of these two poles of the religion of Islam. One way of looking at it is there are these two poles, one of them being Islam itself, the word meaning surrender, giving oneself up to God and to reality. Of course, God is reality with a capital R, and that's just a that's letting go, completely, you know, utter, absolute, abject surrender. And then the other pole is associated with the word jihad, which is so often mistranslated as holy war, which is not what it means at all. Jihad, of course, means struggle. And I know during Ramadan, Faz, I feel both of these, there's a kind of a surrendering to the state of not eating and not, you know, not drinking, the state of fasting. There's a sort of a surrendering into that state. And then there's also a sort of a struggle to maintain that state at the same time. Those are two different spiritual impulses, the impulse of absolute surrender and then the impulse to strive.
Sure. You can look at it semantically, saying that to the act of submitting and surrendering is in itself a struggle. It's itself a struggle to do that, because what you're struggling against is your own wish to play God and to be God and to be master of your own self, and you're sort of struggling to keep what the Prophet Muhammad said, that the nafs, or the soul that tends to rebel against what's right and what's good for you. You're struggling against that. Right. So yeah, all these psychodynamics are at work, and for different people, they feel it different ways. And it's great to share, mutual experiences with not just amongst Muslims, but I know some of my Christian friends and Jewish friends have tried fasting a day or half a day, and anyone's invited to try, with the right intention.
Yeah, I've had students do that when I've taught introduction to Islam classes at colleges. They've sometimes tried a day of fasting just to see what it's like. And I always tell them that it actually gets better. You know, if you're just fasting for one day, you're getting all of the pain and none of the glory.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Glory, but, right. It's the benefit. It's the psychic benefit. It feels better. It's a lot easier. It feels better later on. The first day is tough. We'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett talking with Dr. Faz Khan, the original American Muslim 9/11 truth activist. We'll be right back.
Uncover the Truth with Catherine Albright, live from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Monday to Friday, right here on We the People Radio Network.
Truth Jihad Radio, right here at We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Faz Khan, who pioneered the 9/11 Truth Movement along with some other folks from a pretty early stage and worked with me to found the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth on the web at mujca.com. Currently, the director there, the coordinator, is Lou Stoltenberg, a Methodist from Madison, Wisconsin, who's doing a very good job trying to help bring this important information into the American religious community. Here's another spiritually charged question for you. Politics is very much the domain of ego. And, of course, as you were saying earlier, this ego, or in Arabic, the nafs, the ego that commands evil is really what we're trying to get past and avoid. And Islam tells us that we should be ruled by good people, that politics, or the social system should be run by people who are commanding good and forbidding evil. And yet, politics seems to be the realm of the nafs, of this ego, this desiring ego. And so often, including in Muslim societies, it's the domain of evil, of greed heads and egomaniacs and all of that.
Yes.
How do we resolve this contradiction?
Well, that's a, I mean, that's a great point you make, Kevin. This has been very, you know, long recognized in various religious traditions that government control, temporal, the so-called struggle between the spiritual and the temporal is a perennial issue. This is something that the founding fathers of this nation certainly knew very, very, very well. To minimize government. I mean, so you have this the cynicism, the skepticism, this need to limit those who would ascend to the temporal authority. You know, this is a perennial human dilemma. I don't think there's any quick fixes. The fact that within, you know, 30 or 40 years of the death of the Prophet Muhammad in the Islamic tradition, the old aristocracy has reasserted itself and had essentially terrorized or out and out assassinated any spiritual threat to their hegemony is another what I call a poor prognostic sign. Of course, I'm referring to the reestablishment of the Umayyads and the assassination of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. So there you go, right? There you have it. You have this understanding in the Islamic world that, you know, just be a little cautious when it comes to presidents and kings and sultans. You know, that's not to say they're uniformly condemned in a salvational sense, but that is to say, like you say, the domain of running the affairs of other human beings is something that is fraught with what's called spiritual constipation, that it takes a very special person to be able to do that and retain their spiritual integrity.
Well put. And since you suggest that Muslims are skeptical of government power and authority, as or at least we hope they are, and there is that thread throughout Islamic tradition, then, you know, maybe Muslims should consider taking a look at the Libertarian Party.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm running for Congress as a Libertarian here in Wisconsin. Congress.us. There's my little plug.
No, Kevin, I can tell you, I mean, I don't want to cut you off, but I can tell you the only political platform that really intuitively resonates with what I think the Islamic ethos are the libertarians, the ones that are sort of trying to clean up the agendas and get back to honest, sort of transparency and disclosure and rid policymaking of ideological agendas or special interest groups. I mean, so folks like the libertarians are someone I think a mature American Muslim would automatically gravitate to the libertarian platform. There's no doubt about it.
Right, and another aspect of it is that Ron Paul, who's really a libertarian, even though he's officially a Republican. He's as far from being a neocon Republican as anybody in the country. But anyway, he ran as a Republican. Ron Paul, of course, is calling for the end of the Federal Reserve, the private money monopoly that creates most of the world's currency at interest, out of nothing. Muslims are against interest, are they not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one thing I'm hoping that the Patriot community and the traditional Catholics and even the traditional Jews who also understand that usury is banned in the halakha. The real last resistance to sort of global finance and interest-based banking is the Islamic Sharia. This is something that is very important for people to understand that they have a strong ally in the Islamic community. For those Americans and libertarians who realize just how in the grip this country has become of banks and usury-based finance.
And if people are interested in one practical Muslim effort to reform the planet's currency, you can just Google Islamic gold dinar and find. That project is coming along rather slowly, unfortunately.
Mm.
The plan was to kind of flood the world with Islamic gold dinars and have some of the Islamic countries only accept that rather than funny money. It's come along slowly. I think if any Islamic country ever actually did that, they would quickly get a visit from the CIA jackals.
Oh, of course. There's no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, that's the acid test right there, Kevin. I mean, I don't know if you know who Franklin Sanders is. He's if you go on themoneychanger.com, I've spoken with him a couple of times on the phone. He was he began to redeem people's paychecks in gold and silver. And he didn't have to report. He refused to report it to the IRS because this was money for money. It was just exchanging money. And within a couple of months, he had a SWAT team at his house. I mean, if there's no more sensitive indicator of where the weakness lies, it is this fraudulent banking system. And and to do away with the Federal Reserve and I mean, Ron Paul doesn't want to do away, I don't think, with the idea of fiat currency. He just wants fiat currency to be at the control of the people, i.e. the government, not private interest in banks.
Well,
so
yeah,
I think
he might want to get back to the precious metals.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, that's ultimately the end game. But again, I don't think many Muslims, even Kevin. And again, I don't know how much of a Muslim audience you have, but for the non-Muslim audience, yeah, for the non-Muslim audience, they should know that the Quran actually calls usury or interest, same thing really, as being in a state of war with God. I don't think any other sin is handled with such harsh words. Yet, you know, this whole notion of modern banking is completely off the radar of these quote-unquote Muslim reformers that are trying to heal, you know, the relationship between Islam and the West and blah, blah, blah. They don't realize that the gravest sin, being at war with God and his messenger, is to engage in usury and interest-based finance. You know, whether we're guilty or not, you know, I don't know. But certainly those who are deliberately profiting from this, they're you know, spiritually, in my opinion, and in the opinion of others, are in danger. I mean, there's a reason why Christ assaulted the money changers, as they say. I mean, that's where the evil starts spreading. I mean, that's the only time where the lamb turned into the lion,
right,
according to the biblical record.
Right. Well, some of these moderate Muslims who defend the current system claim that it worked very, very well. That's why the West has gotten so wealthy, and then they claim that moderate interest is not usury. But I guess one response to that is that this explosion of wealth in the Western world over the last couple hundred years has been more the result of the imperial takeover of the world.
It's called theft.
Right. It's called an explosion of fossil fuels. You know, without the fossil fuels and the world takeover, usury would have done much.
Yeah, I've heard this. I've heard this argument that they say, well, modern interest doesn't count as the sinful interest, you know, and if we could prove that the interest that we use in modern times generates more wealth for and a better living for people, then we can have a dispensation here. But I don't see the proof. I mean, look at the world. I mean, look at the maldistribution of wealth and the enslavement of entire nations. I mean, people are being born in the third world in debt. I mean, they come out of their mother's wombs and they're already in debt for no reason.
Well,
that's ridiculous.
US, every baby is born, I think it's $37,000.
Yeah,
scary thought. Well, it looks like we're facing the music, Fuzz, at the end of the show. But it's been wonderful having you on. It's always great to hear your voice and have a conversation on or off the radio. I wish you well. Ramadan Kareem to you and yours.
Yeah, Ramadan Kareem Mubarak to you. Good luck in your campaign, Kevin. And you have my support, of course.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Be well. Wa'alaikum salam.
Okay, that was Dr. Fuzz Town, the original American 9/11 truth activist. I'm Kevin Barrett on the web at barrettforcongress.us. And we'll be back next week. Until then, have a good one.